Before we begin, I would like to emphasize that this podcast is separate from my teachings and work at Del Seton Medical Center. Any discussions we have on this podcast is for entertainment purposes only and in no way connected to Del Seton Medical Center.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast. Welcome, everybody. This is another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. I am here with my Flow amigo.
Stop it.
Dr. Lucas Ferrer, and he is a vascular surgeon here in the city of Austin, Texas. I am Miguel Montero Baker. I'm also a vascular surgeon in the city of Houston, Texas. And today, we don't have a guest.
No, we don't. So we get to rant.
You know, what's interesting about this whole podcast thing is you start realizing certain things about yourself that you didn't really notice before. And one of the things that I've come to realize is, it is not egotistical. I just think it's cool, but it's really cool to listen to your own voice.
Really?
I think it's really cool because with the, you know, we've got these things on.
Yeah.
And I really like that you can get really close to the microphone and like drop your voice, but that still is going to be well comes across. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah. What I've noticed listening to like the podcast again, like, weeks later, it's like, oh, I still don't know how to speak English that well.
I thought my English was so good.
Yeah, it isn't.
I know. You know what? I know. I've noticed. You know, I made me feel really good the other day. You know, one thing that my wife Jenna she picks on me constantly. She's always trying to pick up on little things that I say, and one of the things that's really funny is when I'm trying to like say like an American saying and I totally butcher it. Yeah. And I noticed that you were doing the same thing the same other thing, day, dude, and all I was the time. Like, so happy that I'm not alone.
Yeah.
This is when, the English as a Second Language podcast. Welcome to Open English.
Yeah, when I first moved to the States from Puerto Rico, like, I think at the beginning of intern year, somebody made fun of, like, how I was speaking English, and I was like, fuck, I need to, like, improve this. So I tried the best I could. I guess I didn't do that good. But then when I became, like, a professor, I was like, man, I should have a thicker Spanish accent because that would go with, like, the persona of a professor. And then I would listen to the podcast. Oh, okay, I got it.
I need to pull an Antonio Banderas.
Yeah, that's it. I was thinking
I need
like
to really work on it, and then you listen to yourself, and it's like, and then it's important that I.
Yeah,
I mean, my mom is American and my dad is Costa Rican, and so what I've been told is my mom would speak English to me. Mm-hmm. And I would answer in Spanish to her. Mm. And then my dad would speak Spanish to me and I'd answer in English. And so I really don't have a great excuse. But, I mean, I did grow up all my life. I left Costa Rica, I want to say, by the age of late 20s.
Yeah, me too.
And so, yeah, essentially I lived a life of Spanish speaking, and I would say that's my mother language, but then I can refine it. Like if I'm really trying, like I can really come across
pretty,
very American.
Pretty well.
But it's funny because when I'm nervous or when I'm on the podium or when I'm heated, like in a, you know, if I'm fighting, like if I'm arguing at home over, you know, forgetting to buy milk or what have not. then it switches and I'm like, and listen, you want your milk, you pick up your bloody milk on the way home. You know, like it just switches like that. It's really funny.
All right, we're digressing.
Listen, no, we're not, because this is exactly what a rant is. Yeah, but here's, I'm going to, this is, I literally, okay, for those at home, I'm going to ask our,
you have to keep it still.
I'm going to ask, well, I'm just showing it because I'm going to ask our super producer Ali to put this on for those that have a video on. Yeah, because my wife, Ali, my wife has a list of my sayings. I literally just asked her, can you send me a list? And she screenshots it and it says Miguel's sayings.
Yeah.
So I'll be like, Jenna, do you know what I heard on the Vine today? And she's like, what? And she's like, through the grapevine? Like, what are you trying to say? So I was like, do you know what I heard on the Vine? And then I came in and I'm talking about some other thing at work. And I was like, I don't know. I smell a dead mouse in this situation. And she's like, what?
Translating from Spanish. Yeah.
And then I was talking about this girl. Like, we went to dinner with this couple and it was super funny.
Yeah.
And she was just being very odd and jealous. And I was like, I don't know how this guy does. She's constantly dick patrolling her. Yeah. And then it's like, are you trying to say cock blocking? And I was like, yeah, that dick patrol. And then the last one is, I was trying to say the desert rolls that just kind of fly by on Western movies.
Oh, the she's tumbleweed? Like,
that's called tumbleweed, idiot. So okay. You know, all I really want to apologize to our listeners
language,
because we try our best, but at the end of the day, we you know, err a lot. Anyway, Lucas, you know, one of the coolest things that happens, and Ali, so my saying, by the way, I jumped over a few ones that shouldn't probably be on posted, but right now I'm on my phone, Lucas, and you're gonna love this, and we're gonna post this, Ali, too. I'd like you to post this. But this is from a patient's family. Literally, I just got this. And I'll describe it to those of you that are driving and don't care to look at our dumb faces. But it's a very healthy-looking wound on a foot of a patient that is the father of two physicians in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy's, I want to say 88, 89 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
6 months ago was doing some gardening.
Mm-hmm.
Active guy. And something about he stumped his foot or something doing some minor stuff in the yard.
Yeah.
And had an infection that mm-hmm. ended up being evolving into gangrenous infected first and second toe. And he comes into the hospital and the only alternative he's given is to lose his leg.
Why?
A major amputation. The reason was because the team that was caring for him did the workup. The workup showed that this was a very ischemic extremity.
Mm-hmm. What's a workup?
Vascular ultrasound, essentially.
Just ultrasound.
Yeah. Okay. And so the vascular ultrasound shows, you know, flat waveforms, you know, the toes couldn't be measured because that's obviously a limitation of the toe brachial index. The duplex showed monophasic waveforms distally, and he gets an angiogram. Okay. The angiogram.
So part of the workup is the angiogram.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, well, it was supposed to be a therapeutic angiogram, but they get in there. The femoral popliteal axis is widely patent. And then he's got three vessel disease from the knee down,
mm-hmm.
and essentially no flow from the ankle down to the toes.
Yeah.
And fortunate for this guy, unfortunate, I think in general,
mm-hmm.
that the advocates behind this gentleman were two physicians.
Yeah.
And so.
So he's end-stage renal, he's diabetic. What is he?
He is a diabetic patient. He is not on dialysis.
Okay.
He's medically fairly optimized. Cognitive-wise, he's fine. Mm-hmm. Like I said, he was doing his yard when there was something happening.
Yeah.
And, you know, he gets to the point where they're like, there's nothing we can do. this was originally an angiography done by a cardiologist. Mm-hmm. He got the vascular surgery team involved. They came, they analyzed, they looked at the films, and everybody, that was the consensus. We mm-hmm. can't do anything. And so the physicians go and research. Mm-hmm. And they had heard something about some of these new procedures for, quote, no option CLTI.
Yeah.
And so they come back and they tell the cardiologist, hey, you know, we would really love if there's any shot at doing this, can we get this patient evaluated? And so the cardiologist, probably knowingly or unknowingly, reaches out to the one guy that he's heard does this in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And it was Zola.
Yeah.
And so Zola takes the phone call.
We should have Zola on the podcast.
And Zola should come on the podcast, please.
Zola, come on the podcast.
Yeah, if you're out there. I promise I won't do my grippy voice. Okay. anyway, so Zola says, you know, you should call Miguel because he's in town. Mm-hmm. And so this guy said, of course, maybe. Then it didn't come up, right? The importance of marketing and being in everybody's ear. So he reaches out to me. And I said, of course, I'll see this patient. Mm-hmm. And so I analyzed the films and I look at everything. And
anatomy? Describe the anatomy, the specific.
Oh, boy. This was, I want to say this was 7 months ago, 6 months ago. Hmm? Yeah, about 6 months ago. So I don't quote me, but it was essentially a perineal that got down to the foot, very arthritic with very poor collaterals. Mm-hmm. There was maybe a scant metatarsal, but it was all calcium. Mm-hmm. It was a medial artery calcification of the great stage 5 or great high grade. Mm-hmm. And the anterior tibial fizzled out at the ankle and the posterior was occluded at the ostium.
Okay.
So essentially, this is what we particularly call.
So was it the, so, okay, let's keep going.
No, it's important.
That's important. Yeah.
It's important. It's an important part of this algorithm because when do you consider, and this is actually an interesting question, I'd like your answer. For me, this is a patient that probably needs a primary arterialization. And
a hybrid.
Meaning you're going to arterialize as a primary revascularization approach.
Approach, yeah.
Before offering some sort of half-ass endovascular attempt when I don't necessarily feel that there's a good target on the foot. And I'll tell you why I want you to answer this question, because our good friend who also was on the pod, August Issa, he has a very, very absolutely different perspective on this. He feels you have to give it your best shot at overly complex arterial mm-hmm. reconstructions. Be it with metatarsal access loop.
Wait, metatarsal access is like something like three people in the world can do.
Well, he is one of those. I know. I've seen it. But
yeah, I know. No, I know. But yeah.
Yeah, you mean it's...
like, it's difficult to get some of my colleagues to like consider, you know, retrograde access as a standard thing I do in most of my cases, then you're going to tell them, okay, you stick the toe.
So what do you think about that? Like, what do you think about a situation where there's a high max score?
Yeah.
The patient has an overly poor gross anatomy.
Yeah.
So that's you don't have a
target. That was a first toe.
Yeah. It's a first and second toe. Yeah. No, actually a first toe only.
Yeah.
I'll come to the second toe eventually, but yeah. It was a first toe only. Do you consider arterialization as a primary care pathway without trying an overly aggressive arterial reconstruction first?
I would think that erring... So there's no answer to this question.
Of course not. No,
this is an opinion. There is no answer to this
question. Medicine based on experience and not
on data. And I don't think there'll ever be. Because if you are... It depends
who
you...
This podcast is brought to you by...
By who?
Bozo the Clown Journal of Medicine.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but it's like, this is for educational and entertainment purposes.
Somebody's going to come up with a paper saying this is how you're going to have to do it, but I don't know. I don't know if we'll be there, but depends who you are. If you are Mariano Palena, then you stick that toe and come up with a V18 and get flow. That might be doable. And he writes a paper... That's what he's going to write. I've tried to stick toes and come up. It worked like once. Mm-hmm. And I've tried it a couple times. So that's not my primary strategy to do anything, you know. The question is, this is a variation on that question. So it's not the first toe, it's the third toe. And you have an AT that goes down. There's a ton of, I love seeing the x-ray. I look like looking at an x-ray. I can tell like who needs an angiogram from a foot x-ray.
Yeah.
With these patients, because if they have a ton of calcification,
exactly.
Sometimes the resident told me, oh, I felt he has a great pulse. And I'm looking at the foot x-ray. It's like, no. You want to bet? Yeah. They think I have neuropathy on my fingers because I can't feel the pulse. But I was like, there's no way.
There's absolutely no way.
But so this is a variation of this question. You have an atretic DP. There, you have a metatarsal branch that goes to the first toe, but there's nothing going to the toe that's affected. And you get flow into those metatarsals, say first and second, but there's still nothing that goes to that third toe. Is that an arterialization patient? And I would say that maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Like a good maybe. Like I don't know the answer. Maybe. A strong maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, I'll tell you why I strongly support this pathway. It is not necessarily only about how difficult it is to perform an uber distal complex foot reconstruction. And as you well pointed out, you know, count it with one hand, the people that we think categorically, let's say 2 out of 3 times they could get it done.
Yeah.
Very few people in the world. But let's say that we would remove that complexity.
No, why are you removing the complexity? It's
inherent to the procedure. Because I want to just express the reason why I don't necessarily like it. So let's say that we obviate that step, and let's say that we find the right tools that allows us to do that more and more.
Yeah.
The patency of that intervention is terrible.
It's terrible. Yeah.
And so what happens with that is you have a wound on a Wi-Fi stage of 3, right? Let's say you have 4-foot gangrene. I'm not talking about a speck, little dusty, you know, a real thing that's going to need some foot reconstruction. And you're doing this procedure that's going to take you 4 hours, maybe more. And then you're looking at, you know, a month to 3 months if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you come back, by the way, it looks even worse.
You're talking about the DVA or talking,
no, no, no,
you're
talking about the these super complex loop things like you're doing a metatarsal artery angioplasty.
Yeah.
When that restenosis, that thing looks horrible. And the next time, and they are inequivocally coming back to clinic, the moment that goes down, the wounds are going to get worse. They do get that honeymoon period.
Yeah.
They'll look great. They're healing for a month and then it starts stalling and then it gets worse.
Yeah.
And I can tell story after story of that happening.
Yeah.
Whereas if I say this is a high risk candidate for these complex loop interventions, this patient is likely going to benefit from an arterialization. The patient has a good profile.
Yeah.
Anatomically speaking, the patient has a venous pedal mapping that supports this procedure.
Yeah.
And I get this procedure
done. What's your venous pedal mapping? Do you just stick an ultrasound to it? Or do you do a venogram? Does it matter?
No. That's why you go to Hope Vascular and Podiatry and you can take a course with us.
Good plug. Yeah, thank you.
No, but this is true. Like we have this thing called Hope Academy. And actually this is a plug for, in December we have our first course where we're going to be training RVTs in expansion arterial duplex for CLTI. And one of the things that we do is everybody that has CLTI not only gets this expanded duplex where they look at the foot and they look at the anatomy of the arteries, but we actually map the veins. And so we get diameters, consistency, and quality of lateral plantar.
When is that in December? I might go train as an RVT.
Yeah, I mean, physicians are, it's funny because we have a lot of Latin American physicians.
I love those. Every time Jill presents one of her mappings, I'm like, can I take you home with me?
Can I take you to work with me is what you have to be thinking. Okay. Let's see if she picks up. Let's see. And it should be cool. Let's see if we can pick up. Let's see. I'm calling Jill Somerset, RVT. Cold calling somebody on the podcast.
First time ever.
How bad would it be that she doesn't pick up? Like, what a haterade. And then it's going to be recorded forever.
We'll just edit it out.
I want this to stay. I want this shamefully.
She didn't answer.
Don't you wait till the voice message?
No.
Are you?
If she rings three times, you hang up.
Please leave your message for
Jill. This is your ex-friend Miguel and Lucas. We're recording a podcast and we wanted your opinion live, but you know what? We realize that you're not our friend. So
she has more important things.
More important things. Okay, bye.
Okay.
Anyway, let me get back to it. So the reason why I was calling her is I don't know the date. I think it's the first week of December. But I'll make sure that we plug it in and we move it through social media for those people that are, there's tons of interest. The advanced skills course in Chicago. Yeah. We had 75 plus attendees. I can tell you at least 5 to 7 people, because we presented some of the data, came immediately and said, I'm interested as a physician.
Yeah.
And some of them were like, I'm very interested in sending our tech. So there's a lot of interest because I think there's a big need. But anyway, let me just finish. What we do is we look at the consistency and the diameter and the anatomy of the vein. So lateral plantar. Mm-hmm. We look at the medial plantar.
Why do you look at the medial vein?
Veins.
Why?
Because we've realized that some people have actually dominance of the medial plantar versus the lateral plantar.
And you can tell that by ultrasound.
Oh, you can easily tell.
Why? Because of the size?
Mm-hmm. Sizes, and we actually can follow it.
Yeah.
You can see which one goes into the appropriate part of the foot. Then we like to see the perforator vein, which is the connection between the medial marginal vein on the dorsum of the foot and the bottom of the foot at the lateral plantar. We look at the position of the perforator. So is it a good access potential vessel or not?
I've tried that a couple of times because I saw your picture of it and it's never fucking worked.
That's why you have to, is it a class 1, 2, or 3 based on our paper?
Oh my God. You're making this more complicated.
If the angle, I'm just making it easy. Yeah. You can pre-plan your case.
Yeah.
Listen, I love the following thing that I've said. How much do you plan for a complex EVAR?
A lot.
Yeah. You sit down, you do terror recon, you do all these things, you do center line, then you write these things, and then you have to send it for somebody to validate it, and then it comes back. Why do we cowboy our ass through CLTI?
Yeah.
Why do we not?
That's true.
What's the difference between that patient with an aneurysm?
Because I can tell what I'm going to do based on the angiogram. It takes me 5 seconds in my head.
But that's the thing. I think you should be better at it. I think you should know, A, what type of plaque you're dealing with. A, where is that plaque?
Yeah.
B, what device should you use? C, what access should you use?
Yeah.
No. And all of these things probably let you be much better. And I'm, for somebody like you, a virtuoso in many ways, that's been trained by some of the greatest in history, this is very cowboy for you. It's a very, immediate. It's visceral. You know what to do. You know how to react and you change very adaptively, but not everybody can do that. And the way, I'm not going to go into this, but that's why I think some of the advanced AAA guys, you look at them and you're like, they're not that technically great. No, but there's a lot of, it's mental.
Yes.
Because there's all this planning. Yeah. Well, the same should happen with CLTI.
Yeah, but the inconsistency of ultrasound is what, because I look at the ultrasound, I can basically tell what my target's going to be.
Yep.
Based on the wound and what my access is going to be.
Yep.
In between, super varied. So I see it and I'm like, okay, if something's obvious, it's obvious. But I don't count on my planning on it because I know that there's going to be some little surprise that wasn't picked up.
I am going to throw on Ali. There's a third picture. Well, the first one probably shouldn't go, but the second one definitely has to go on. The third one should go on the screen. And it's the 5 fates of CLTI based on duplex preoperative ultrasound. This is
a, 5 fates?
Yeah. The fates. So what happens?
It's philosophical.
So one's Medicaid, offload and Medicaid.
Yeah.
The second one's operate.
Yeah.
The third one's dilate.
Yeah.
The fourth one's deviate. And the fifth one's amputate. Take a look. And that's all based on...
This is beautiful. Duplex. This is like art.
See? This is duplex and a wound. All and right. we combine those two things.
I'm going to kidnap Jill Somerset.
to take her to work.
Yeah.
But this is... This is Jill's work with, you know, a little bit of polishing and direction and multidisciplinary work that we do at Hope. But it's where I think we should be going.
Yeah.
Where we put a little bit more thought process, put a little bit more planning, operative planning. And I'll throw, you know, also a little bit of love through to Trish Roy, because she's also trying to get me to be better about. She questions these things that are, you know, the questions are very basic and logical, but, you know, yeah, why did you choose that device? Yeah. And my answer is because I know it's going to work best for that.
Yeah.
And she's like, but why? Like, yeah. Experience. It is that. I've done so many cases at this point that I know that one device is going to do phenomenally well in that. But that's exactly, I cannot teach that. There's not enough people that I will be able to touch. And if I'm wanting to help the world in a better way, I have to make
this. I don't know if you can even express it in words.
I don't, but I do believe that advanced imaging, ultrasound, you know, MR, or whatever these things are, should help us better plan our cases, and we should be able to be better doctors.
Okay, let's go back to the case.
So back to the case. So this gentleman has a no-option CLTI. Yeah. We do the venous mapping of the foot. We get all that information. Yeah. We believe it's a good approach.
So you don't have a stump of a PT.
So this one had,
a little stump. Okay. Tell me, so you see the anatomy in your head. Tell me step one, step two.
Yeah. So in, you know, one of the things that we know is that there's two ways to arterialize. You can do it by endovascular means, in which case it's a deep venous arterialization. Or we could do it by open surgery.
Well, somebody did it the other day on the AT, which was supposedly a no-no, right? And had a good result. So that's
correct. Dorsal. But I would think that's still deep system.
Why?
Because the superficial venous system is made of the GSV and the SSV. The AT
connects right where the medial marginal connects.
I understand, but the anterior tibial vein is still part of the deep venous system of the leg.
I guess, yeah. But like anatomically, it lays right next to the medial marginal vein and connects right where it connects and then goes to the perforator and then connects to
it. I mean, I'm sure we could change the books, but I'm just saying the superficial venous system of the foot is made by the saphenous system of the foot.
Yeah.
And it's not about dorsum or plantar, because we could talk about plantar arterialization and dorsum arterialization.
But it's called deep in the calf. Because of its anatomical relation to the anterior tibial artery and such, and the superficial is called superficial, but in the foot, they're geographically in the same place.
Okay, let's call it arterialization of the foot.
Yeah, okay.
Be it because it's going to be via endovascular means, or be it because it's going to be via an open mean.
Yeah.
In my experience thus far, and I have limited experience with anterior tibial vein arterialization.
I have zero.
Given the fact that it's very small, it says in our, you know, we are collecting these diameter studies to look at it. And the AT vein, you know, it's a 2 millimeter vein. I mean, it's a very small vein.
I've never done it because Ferraresi said, don't do it. I tried it, it didn't work. So I said, okay, I'm going to learn from somebody else.
Yeah. And I mean, all we have is, I think two or three reports of people that have said they do it, but I jury's still out of that.
Yeah.
I think we don't have enough patients to think that that's a good alternative. But when we see the anatomy of the leg, what our decision is what we learned very early on is whatever you do, you don't change what's there to begin with, because whatever's there is keeping the foot alive.
Explain that better.
Okay. Let's say that you have a single vessel down to the foot.
Yeah.
And that vessel posterior tibial artery.
Yeah.
The last thing you want to do is do anything that would compromise the trickle flow there is into that posterior tibial, because that is the lifeline of the foot as is. yes, the foot looks crappy. Mm-hmm. Let's say 10% of it is dead.
Yeah.
But that 90% that's alive is staying alive because of those three red blood cells that go through that posterior tibial artery.
Yeah.
Okay. So thinking of doing a procedure that essentially deviates the blood flow from that posterior tibial through a covered stent and into the posterior tibial vein.
You killed the foot.
You immediately overnight are going to lose the leg.
Yeah.
And painfully, we've been there because, you know, we started doing this 7 years ago. And so we realized that's not the right way to do it. And so that's my two senses about this is we have to find a way.
What if the posterior tibial artery ends slightly above the ankle? Would you do a deep arterialization, a distal arterialization?
Yeah.
Using the August Issa VAST technique and what his experience and research.
So
as will you kill those little collaterals at the end?
Well, the question needs to be broader, right? Yeah. I mean, the first bucket is, are you going to try to do this endo or are you going to try to do it open?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
If you had both.
And it's almost like the same as considering somebody for a bypass, right? You need to know that they're a good surgical candidate, that you're going to be able to put them through an open surgery, general anesthesia, and B, that they have a good conduit. And that conduit is not only limited to the saphenous vein above the ankle, but to the saphenous vein and its main outflow vessel to the foot, which is a medial marginal vein. Okay.
I think there's one more.
Or the SSV. Because you could also do an SSV arterialization.
Yeah, I've never done that. But there's
another approach.
Yeah. There's another little caveat to it, especially on, I found, and this is just my experience. Maybe I'm not good at, you know, it's just my technical error I'm doing. But on patients that, especially their end-stage renal, and you do a hybrid approach, that wound at the upper calf, good chance of breaking down.
Yeah.
Good chance of not healing.
Yeah.
So are they equivocal? I might say maybe not, because if that wound's open, I usually like wrap the soleus muscle around it as much as, because I'm kind of preparing for that skin to die.
Yeah.
And the muscle to be exposed and then the skin, all that shebang. So I might say they might not be equal based on that, because if that graft gets exposed, the saphenous vein gets exposed, then you're done.
The complications from open arterialization are significantly more dreadful than any complication from an endo.
Yeah.
The majority of the times, what will happen with the endo is, you know, at worst, you get an occluded stent. No,
you steal too much. That's the biggest. That's a complication.
Well, that's a complication inherited to the arterialization, period.
Yeah.
But trying to look at what each one has that is not inherited to the other, I would say the surgical incisions are a big deal.
Yeah.
One of the things, obviously, we could talk about this for hours, but, you know, overexpansion of your automatic retractions is a huge deal. So
causing trauma to tissue.
Yeah. They have very poor protoplasm. So if you, for an arterialization, if you make a PGY1 help you with that anastomosis, you're going to be A for hours. And those, that incision will be very ischemic by the end of the case. Yeah. And so that's a big deal. You have to be fast. You have to open very strategically. You have to be fast. And I think there's even some, here's my thought. I think there's opportunity for advancements in open technology that can allow you to do a fast and quick anastomosis that doesn't need to be like surgical.
Like those staples you mentioned one time.
I love using the staples for certain.
I've never used them.
AB fistulas. Yeah, you should. They're quick, they're fast, and they're good. But no, I think there's others. And I've actually been collaborating with a couple of companies that help you do a very quick anastomosis that takes 5 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Pretty impressive. But
are they in the market or no?
No. Okay. We're in preclinical studies. But yeah, I think that the surgical carries much more robust complication rates from that, you know, and certainly when we open an incision at the ankle,
that's a no-no, right?
You have to
I don't think
move you away from that.
Yeah, don't do
that's
it.
How I did it at the beginning. Yeah. Do not do that. That one just breaks down immediately. Yeah. It doesn't matter what you do. The ankle opens up.
Yeah. Okay. So we talked about that. So now and this guy you decided to go in though?
You wanted me to land the thought of how I decide. And I'm just telling you that if the anatomy is appropriate, we tend to think that endovascular approach is the best when the posterior tibial artery is completely occluded and it gives no branches off.
Yeah.
When the opposite is true, meaning the posterior tibial artery tends to be the main blood vessel that's keeping the foot alive, we believe that working around it, it's the best. And so using open technique for an insight to arterialization of the GSV and the MMV is the way to go. But in the event that you don't have conduit and you still have a posterior tibial artery main feeder, then our advice is to do an endo arterialization, but coming off from the perineal artery, using the perineal as your supplier. Now, the last question to close the loop on this for the audience that does not have ADHD like you, I'll keep you on point, is the question about doing distal or proximal DVAs.
Yeah.
And I would even push it to the point of doing stentless with or without stent, which is something that we have seen a lot of people do. And I don't think that we have enough information about that, but I do believe this. I don't think that you need these high outflow fistulas. So I do think that as technology improves, we will probably move to seeing better and better technology that creates AV fistula that are less intense.
So less flow.
Less flow. And I'll tie that to your...
Let's make notes because there's a lot of things. So we've talked about a lot of things that are important.
Yeah.
That's one of them, flow volumes. We need to really dive into that because that's super important. And then the other, I want to touch back again on when you decide to do hybrid. The part of do you go in and do a valve lysis right then and there? I think that's important. And how? Because, you know, we at Hendolat, that was a point that was stressed by some of the presenters. We need to come back to that a little. Yeah. My ADHD is going to kick in right.
And
one of the things that we need to, that
this I really want to talk about. Yeah. I feel even though I've got a degree of it, I at least try to keep my mind on where we're going.
Yeah. And then
we also have, we're recording in 15 minutes. We've got 15 minutes to wrap this up.
Okay.
Less than 15.
Okay.
Well, here's the thing. This is going to be part A.
Part A DVA rant. Okay.
Yeah. Part A DVA, where we're only talking about who and when.
Yeah.
And then maybe the next one we go into details of how. Because I think the how is very important and the how we manage the flows. What do we do with it? Why do we have to respond quickly?
Let's talk a little bit about patient selection.
Let's just focus on that.
Because, as we saw in PROMISE 2, end-stage renal disease patients do worse than purely diabetic patients.
PROMISE 2, would you mind expanding what that is for the audience that may have not heard about it?
PROMISE 2 is a multi-institutional international trial where we looked at the limb flow device to create endovascular deep vein arterialization.
It's an IDE study that led to right now the actual commercial approval of the device. So it's FDA approved. Okay, so you're talking about
we have worse outcomes. Yeah, we had worse outcomes in end-stage renal disease patients. In my hands, I've not had a great results with end-stage renal disease patients. I think there's some technical things that I think I was making mistakes on. I think the flow volume should be lower than we were thinking. Yep. We were talking about 100 to 300. I think it should be around 100.
Yeah. I think it's dependent. Okay, I'll get into that, but I feel like that's going into the part B of the discussion.
That is going into the part B, but I'm just saying like what I think my mistakes were.
Yeah, let's drum roll, leave that conversation for another time.
And the other thing is I think that these patients are very, very sick and their life expectancy might not be the year that it takes, the 8 months that it takes for these wounds to heal. I think that's it.
Okay.
That's important.
That's, there's that's a point where you and I have very divergent, I think, points of view.
You have better results than I do. So I mean, you're probably correct on your opinion.
Maybe not necessarily, but let's talk about why. One of the things that's important to first discuss is that patients with renal failure have less survival, right? They're sicker. And
well, not just patients with renal failure, patients with renal failure that have tissue loss and severe mitral artery calcinosis, because they're subsets.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is if you look at this, one of the endpoints that I'm absolutely against is looking at amputation-free survival. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we're doing this procedure as a limb-saving procedure. This is not a life-saving procedure.
Yeah.
And I'm not necessarily saying, please don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that we shouldn't care about a patient's life.
Yeah, but that's
we have to care about the patient's life. But this procedure was made for wound healing of an extremity that is severely ischemic and underperfused.
Yeah.
And if you bulk in the survival into the, you know, the leg preservation, then you're adding a confounding factor to the fact that what we're looking at is wound healing. Now, I don't even think we have good wound healing and CLTI overall objectives for our studies. And that's one thing that we talked with Anaida Dua and Zach Pallister in our last podcast, because there needs to be an overhaul on the objective performance goals and even the endpoints for studies. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be looking at all these. And we should be very, very concerned with why these patients are dying and if there's anything we can do to improve their survival 100%.
Yeah.
And then try to frame what you should do and could do to a certain one of these patients under the understanding that what's the fate of this patient, what's their survival, and what we should be doing.
Yeah.
But removing that whole thing, which seems like a very complex bucket of potential even ethical considerations, I believe it's that patient exactly the one that's going to be the most benefited by this procedure, because they tend to be high max scores. They don't tend to have good conduit. They're not great candidates for an open procedure. And we know that anything we do in renal failure patients normally, like balloon angioplasty or atherectomy and balloon implant, it doesn't last at all anything, and the results are terrible. So it's hard for me to then say, okay, well, if you're going to take the calcified renal failure patients out of this, then now you really narrow the margin of those that actually will benefit from this disease. I mean, from this treatment.
I don't think we should worry about how many. Like, I don't think that's the question, because I think you can't take away the complexity from it. And I think you have to look at the human aspect of it. Like, these people are going to die pretty soon, right? They're going to die pretty soon. End-stage renal disease with wounds, I mean, their life expectancy is not great. So we can do, it's like Ferraresi said when we were having dinner, remember after Link, about accessing the metatarsal artery. Just because you can do a backflip doesn't mean you should be an acrobat or something like that, he said very poetically. Just because we can do this procedure doesn't mean that we should do it. And what I've experienced is that, these people, you get them through the procedure, their wound stabilizes, maybe this starts to heal, but they are suffering. Like, this is an unresolved problem in their life that really affects their mental health. And I've found that when they finally get to the acceptance that they're, at some point they get to the acceptance that they're going to lose the leg, and they come to that acceptance, when they have the amputation, you can see, and this is completely anecdotal and non-reproducible and not something that's going to be ever in the paper, but there is a weight off their shoulders, and there is a, okay, I'm moving on from this. So given the fact that our wound healing rates on end-stage renal disease patients promised to was, 40% maybe, compared to 67% on diabetic patients? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a real question that we should, and that's something that we have to have a really frank conversation. It's like, just because I can do this and just because it's a cool procedure to do and everybody's like, oh, this that's such a great picture and it's so interesting and there's such good science, should I be doing this? I'm not convinced.
We can talk more about what needs to happen for this to work. But there's two other solutions to this, which pose a great moral dilemma, which is one, you're going to get this consult. You're going to decide somehow that this patient's life expectancy is not great. And instead of offering them something that can help them, you're going to go ahead and offer them a major amputation, which can be already incredibly mutilating. Yeah. And I assure you that the mental health issues related to that themselves also are going to be great and potentially may accelerate their path to death, because now they're going to be prostrated in some bed. They're going to be in a SNF. They're never going to get rehab. They're never going to get out. And
that happens with DVAs too. They get stuck in bed. Nobody moves.
That's got CLTI.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there is a perfectly okay path that when somebody's got a not so horrible wound that's not infected, that's not painful, they could get wound hospice too.
Yeah.
And I do that a lot.
I do that a lot too.
I think patients that are high risk that don't have an alternative can get, listen, can you keep this clean? Do you mind? Is this a problem for you? Because it's never going to get better, and you may live with this like this for 2-3 years and your life is going to be fine.
Yeah.
And that's okay. So you can potentially do wound hospice. You can potentially do a major amputation. Or you can potentially talk about this. And here's where I do defer with you, which is I don't think every arterialization's fate is a 6-9 month process. Yeah. Our group, and now I am tooting our horn, usually in 2 months, the majority of these patients are healed.
Yeah.
And the PROMISE II study, do remember, I was knee deep in that study.
Yeah.
Everybody that says they have toe and flow units, they don't. And the podiatric care was a very steep knowledge that had to be adapted. And there was investigators in that study that were learning what podiatric interventions should be done, non-tension closures and all these other things that can't certainly be the difference between getting somebody through this in 8 weeks or having somebody in a SNF for 12 months.
Yeah.
So let's just not remember the DVA requires this interdisciplinary care. Not everybody out there should be offering this as a solution. Not everybody knows how to do it.
What percentage of vascular surgeons have somebody like Brian Lipo, like who's the podiatrist?
Or David Armstrong.
Very few.
Dude. I would say probably 5%.
I
don't have that.
I do my own podiatry on it. And I'm like,
are you willing to learn? Okay, here's the deal. So are you willing to learn new podiatric care?
Dude, I'm willing to learn anything.
Well, that's what I think you should be getting ready for. Yeah. As this company goes out and commercializes, I've been incredibly insistent on the courses moving forward, because here's another, but hope is probably hopefully going to be a place where people come and do this. You need to bring either your podiatrist or you need to be open-minded that we're going to teach you how to do a foot reconstruction again. And I don't care how cocky or how many years you've been doing this or how you think an amputation can be done with your eyes closed. You will have to learn.
Yeah.
And listen to the 7 Year of Experience podcast from our good friends, Giacomo Clerici and Andrea Cassini. That was the biggest learning curve. It was not the arterial. You can tell
them so that I want to go to Italy to learn how to do foot amputations. To Giacomo.
We'll try to make sure we get you on it. But anyway, listen, folks, this has been great. Lucas, I love talking to you about this. This was a great rant.
I love ranting.
Let's do part B next time. Yeah. I think we need to talk about, once you do it, some of the technical aspects.
Yeah.
What are the things that we've learned about intraoperative hemodynamics? How do we decide somebody that has high flow versus low flow?
Yeah.
Can you find that out acutely? And can you maybe react before quoting your last week? You have to go back in within the first 24 hours, given the severe pain.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that and help our audience maybe grow their depth of knowledge in this one particular very exciting area of development.
I love this. This was good.
All right, guys. Thank you very much for being. We'll talk to you on the next one. Pura vida.